Okay, so starting on the end, I'd like to introduce the director of the film, David Gordon Green. And from the cast, we have Scoot McNairy, Billy Bob Thornton, Sandra Bullock, Anthony Mackie, and Zoe Kazan. And the producers, George Clooney and Grant Hesloff. For the radio journalists in the room, they've asked that each of you go down the line and just say your name into the mic so they have a voice print for you. So you
everyone, George Clooney's here. Boom, look at that. Wow. Look at that. Thunderous applause.
We have time for one more question.
David Gordon Green, director.
Somebody dialed into our channel. Pick up one of the hand mics on the table.
They are out in the audience.
They're out. Can somebody grab them a hand mic? Somebody's killing me right now.
We can talk loud.
Kill you.
Yeah. You know, you can go to school for this.
I thought that was...
Yeah. You can learn how to fix that.
Oh, you just alienated everyone.
Look at that. Turn off your
hand. Getting much better.
I feel bad for the person wearing headphones.
Did our press conference get hacked?
Yeah, we've been hacked.
That's gangsta, man.
No, no.
We got hacked.
Well, this is great.
This is so sexy.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming.
Everyone.
We can do with one hand. We can do with one hand. My back and not use one. So, David, thank you for your voice.
Let's do the intro.
You want to do that?
Yeah. We got everybody here. It seems silly to kind of.
All right.
Cold. Yeah.
What did you say we're doing?
Who listens to radio anyway?
Wow. He does not represent the opinion.
Easy. He does.
All right, let me start with a question for George and Grant. We've had conversations several times that it's impossible, with the amount of time that it takes for films to be made, it's impossible to be purposefully timely. Did you guys ever have in your mind that you would want this film out right in the middle of an election cycle? Was that the plan? Because it's kind of juicy.
We actually knew that Trump was running.
So. I'd actually no, you know, when we talked about release dates, we knew that we wanted it to come out sooner rather than later because we figured as time goes on, people are going to get really tired of talking about any form of election politics. But that's about it. The rest of it was left.
And did you push for, once the film was done, it could have come out this fall, it could have come out next spring. Did you guys push for now because we are kind of early on in this process? Yeah.
Yeah, later would not have been as good. I think people would be angry later. You can just see the anger building as the months go on.
Right. David, you've made so many different kinds of films, from really intimate character pieces like Undertow and All the Real Girls to insane comedies like Pineapple Express or Your Highness. Do you feel like this movie combines so much of the different kinds of movies that you've been able to make?
Yeah, I think that's what attracted me to it, is that it had a great emotional core to it, but yet it didn't limit the wit that was possible, and we could really try to find that balance of something that felt like it had dramatic weight, but also comedic opportunity.
For Billy Bob and Sandra, Jane and Pat have such a great relationship. It's kind of the did they ever or didn't they ever thing, but it's also a great rivalry. How did the two of you try to keep things unpredictable and keep each other on your toes while you were filming, even though you were sticking to the screenplay?
We had a relationship in real life, so we chose in the movie to say that we didn't as those characters.
But what we did is we just allowed certain awkward and uncomfortable moments from the demise of that relationship to seep into various moments that were pivotal to the script. We said, is this appropriate to allow in what happened when you did that really horrible thing to me that time?
Right.
Into this moment, and then remember when I got revenge and really fucked you, is that appropriate to bring in now? And we found a good balance with that, which I think kept it alive. And it would look at the sexual tension was just palpable. It was you can't manufacture it. Either is or it isn't, and it was. And I think what you see is the end result of our power. Right? Am I right on that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Can you recall a moment on set where Billy Bob did something that threw you off?
Yeah, he opened his mouth. You did not know. There's about 2.5 hours of footage where David just had us behind that screen say the most bizarre things and just let us go, and it was just became more and more just creepy.
It was weird.
Yeah. Just really.
It was really weird. It was helpful. But he did have us do a lot of things that weren't scripted, just to, I guess, to wind us up. But to be serious for a moment, the script was so well written that we essentially just had to kind of do what was there. And she's so not only talented but easy to be around. That
easy on the eye as well, right?
And easy on the eyes. There's not much of a way to be anything other than natural around her anyway. So it was, and I mean that sincerely. But it was just great writing, and we both know those people, you know? I mean, we've been around the type. So it was all between that, you know, the writing and that, and David's wonderful direction, it was a snap.
Here's a question for Anthony and Scoot. Your characters, Ben and Buckley, they have different ways of dealing with ethical dilemmas. When you think about the characters, what's a trait that each of your characters has that you wish you had, and what's a trait that your characters have that you're happy you don't?
Well, it's 2015, so David put an underlying layer of sexual tension between us as well.
And me and Anthony were having a relationship
right,
as well.
Right. A lot of Budweiser. Go ahead, Scoot. You answer that.
One of the things that I think Buckley is sort of a fish out of water. He kind of gets into this thing as if it will be just like an advertising, branding something. And I think that when he gets down there, he realizes that he's very much a fish out of water in this environment, and as well as he has really a difficult time keeping up with Jane's pacing. And so for me, that was, one of the things about his character that I think that kind of evolved, once I got there, and, from working with David as well. I mean, he does take these scenes so far left field, you know what I mean? It's almost sort of this kind of exercise, but you find so much through taking these scenes in these directions and stuff. And as well as an actor, it's so pleasant and so much fun to just kind of explore and play around on those days. And so, that was one of the things that I wish I could do more on films, is have that ability and that time to really just explore and just take things in directions that it's not going there, but you find, in doing that, you do find something about the character or about the scene or about the film.
Anthony?
Oh, what was the question?
What about Ben do you wish you shared quality-wise, and what are you happy you don't?
I've definitely enjoyed the moral aspect of Ben. I felt like there was a tranquil idea of humanity that was in him that he never allowed his outside relationship with the world to influence exactly who he was in a negative way. I feel like that's something I always wish I had about myself, instead of just going around cursing people out and wanting to punch them in the face. So the way we worked on this movie was so interesting. I feel like at no point in time, believe it or not, Sandy's a very humble person and a very everyday...
They believe it, they know me.
Yeah. Just, and if there's a way of saying this, just a very average person that positively... person inside. Your heart is so neutral.
I think normal.
Normal person. And so it makes her easy to work with and enjoyable to be around, because she's so above average.
That's how you say it.
Workmanlike.
Workmanlike.
When I think about you in this movie, I think about the line I love so much from Broadcast News, where Albert Brooks says to Holly Hunter, "It must be so nice to always think you're the smartest person in the room," and she goes, "No, it's awful."
Actually, her boss says that to her.
Which is that's
flowers.
Right.
There's Zoe, the smartest one in the
group. There she goes, boom.
So I guess my question is, what is it like in a cast of characters as intelligent as the ones in this movie? What is it like to be the smartest?
Yeah.
You gotta deal with that.
Well, honestly,
LeBlanc is a person who keeps her opinions to herself a lot of the time, so it's easy for her to look like the smartest person in the room because she's not saying what she's really thinking. I think a lot of these other characters take a much bigger personal risk. They put themselves out more.
Okay.
And risk looking stupid, even if they're not.
All right, so for the questions, there's mics on either side, mm-hmm. and Rachel and Cecilia, there's only one mic that works. That's right, there's one mic. So it's being passed around. Who's got it? Hi.
This is for George and Sandra. What was the best part about reuniting and doing another movie together?
Being where?
About reuniting.
Nothing.
No.
Did you guys learn anything new about each other?
Nope. Same shit.
Sandy and I have known, and Grant, actually, the three of us have known each other.
Too long.
Long before, yeah, like, because Sandy's 64 years old. She was much older.
Hey, George, don't poke the bear.
Okay, yeah, you're right about that. We have a long history together. I don't know if we learn anything else. It's just always fun to work together.
Well, what's nice is just to sort of be able to work together. Like, you grow up, you think, you share life experiences, you share your mellowing out, you share your hopefully your new sense of self, like you've learned something hopefully, like it's nice that we work in a place where you're allowed to keep coming back and have new experiences, and I don't think any of us take that for granted, but to be able to sit with Grant and George and argue about what we're impassioned by, and we might all come from different places, we all ended up with the same end result, which was what was best for the movie, and we're good at arguing our points of view and never feeling like it got personal. So that's what I really appreciate about the opportunity to do it. And
there's also something kind of great about the idea that when we first met,
you were drunk.
I was drunk. We literally couldn't get hired for the most part. And,
yeah.
And
Grant was the only one working at the time.
Yeah, where did you got?
He was making videotapes, audition tapes.
That's right. And he did an episode of Joey Loves Chachi and Chachi, which is true. But you know, there's something really fun about being able to experience these years of change in your life and being able to come up and say, all right, now we're in the middle of an incredibly creative period of time in our lives, and say, you know, have Sandy call up and say, well, let's make this movie. How about if I do it and I play the part, and us going, well, let's sit down and figure it out. That's really exciting because, you know, when you're doing a guest shot on Joni Loves Chachi, you don't really think that that's going to be, you know, the next thing that happens in your career. So it's a really fun experience that I think we've always had together.
So when you guys are producers and Sandra, you're executive producer, who's the boss of who?
Sandy's the boss.
Yeah.
Sandy's
no matter
boss.
What the...
Yeah.
Honest to God, she's the boss.
Over here, for George, Anthony, Sandra, Billy, the political junkie tends to start early in life. Maybe somewhere early 20s, someone makes an impression on them and it should help shape their political views. Did any of that happen to any of you very early in life? Not that you're much older than 20, of course.
I had a eighth grade civics teacher named Greer Rowland. That was her real name.
It's a great name.
That's an awful name. And awful name. And she was really into making sure that we were politically aware of what was going on. And, you know, it was just all white noise to us. And then all of a sudden, like, everything just exploded in New Orleans with the mayor and the governor, and then the the World's Fair had just left New Orleans, and it was all this turmoil about what were we going to do with all this shit, you know. And then all these people got arrested. That's when the mayor got caught like with some stuff that he shouldn't have got caught with someone he shouldn't have been with.
Right.
And then police started arresting police, and I was like, you know. Politics became extremely interesting to me because no one had any moral boundaries. You know, there was this case where this police officer was robbing drug dealers and selling drugs to drug dealers in a neighboring neighborhood. And one of the people in the neighborhood told the police that the police was robbing drug dealers, and he came and killed the person. And literally 10 years later, it was like, oh, you're arrested. And by that time, he was like retired and tenured and all this stuff. And it went all the way back up to like state reps and everybody. And I just always found that interesting with politics, how, you know, when you go to the bar at night and the mayor's in there to having a seedy conversation, you know, it's just New Orleans.
Not just New Orleans.
Who else has an answer for that?
Just about Beep, growing up in a sort of political vein. Is everything.
And whether there was someone in particular that sparked a political...
Well, I think if you're sort of our age, not Sandy's, our age.
64.
Sandy's much younger. Men in my state. You know, we grew up in a time where, you know, you had the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam movement and the drug culture, counterculture, you had the assassinations. I mean, if you weren't somehow politically involved, then, you know, all of us were. You just, that was part of your, you know, your makeup. It was part of your DNA. And, you know, Watergate comes around. I mean, you just all lived with us. So from a very early age, we were sort of indoctrinated into the idea of being involved and being socially aware, so that by the time we were aware of, you know, Mandela and apartheid in the early 80s, when it really started to catch on, that was something that you could get involved in and be a part of. So, you know, it just was part of our DNA. If you're of a certain age, you know, you weren't able to duck into a cell phone or, you know, watch TV to get out of it.
Now, I think the Kennedy assassination probably, because George and I are probably the closest in age of the people up here. So we grew up
lucky.
We're in our late 40s. And we have the same facial hair and the whole thing. But the Kennedy assassination was so devastating to so many people. And we were little. And, you know, George is younger than I was. I was 8 years old when Kennedy was assassinated. And so they let us out of school, you know, and then we came back to school and there were televisions in every classroom and we watched the funeral on television. And I think as an 8-year-old seeing that, and you see how the adults are reacting to it and people crying in the streets and everything, I think that had such a profound effect on all of us, sort of baby boomers or whatever. And then, as George said, that decade carried on with more of the same, with Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, Kent State, and all of those events, and then Watergate. So we had no choice but to be aware of the political climate and things that, you know, dealing with the government and everything. And I think it made me read about it. I know that much.
Sandra, anything to add?
I mean, I was raised in Washington, D.C., Arlington, Virginia, born in D.C., and raised in a household where one was Republican, one was Democratic. So I got both sides. And the thing that I remember the most is not understanding why, if you were doing the right thing, why did people want to kill you? That was a question I remember asking my parents that they couldn't answer. Why is it that when people are trying to help other people and they're stepping forward, why do they get killed? And I remember not getting an answer for that. And I know that they couldn't answer that because I was too young to understand, I think, the bigger picture of it. But, you know, I've always been, I'm not politically vocal. I just want what's best for our country. I would like my rights represented, those of my son, you know, those very selfish views. I think everyone else has them, but I you know, like when this film came along, it came along at a time that I was having that sort of internal discussion with myself about, you know, who in our country would step out of their comfort zone to help others for the greater good. You know, I'd watched the Freedom Riders documentary many times. There's one story that just really affected me about this young woman who, first to go to college, she went and told her parents, "I'm going to leave college in order to ride and to represent the future." And I mean, I was so moved by that. I go, who would do that now? Who would do that for my son? I would, but I would do anything for my son. But, like, what people would still get together and peacefully protest for the greater good? And then this came along, and I went, wow, it's really interesting that this is what I've been thinking about, and the universe gives you something that might be set in Bolivia, but it could be set anywhere, about who's willing to get off the carousel of success and winning and making money and how they look, to let that go and put your neck out for the greater good? Have we all gotten too scared and too safe? I don't know. You know, so that all stemmed from how I grew up. You know, my parents broke the mold. They did things that were not fashionable. They were, my mother was definitely ahead of her time as a woman. I never realized I was a woman and that there were, I mean, I know it's female, but I never realized that there were limitations or I was looked at as less than until I was actually pretty deep in this business and I had a pretty unsettling moment. And I went, oh my God, I'm being treated this way because I'm female. So a lot of things started bubbling up, were allowed to, you know, like to blossom in me. And I don't know if it's politically, you know, public, I don't know. But I grew up to be exactly who I was supposed to be and have the opinions I wanted to have and didn't realize that there were limitations to that until, you know. So I thought politically I was pretty open-minded and could speak my mind, and then I realized I wasn't supposed to. Yeah.
Where's the mic?
Oh, okay. This is for Grant, George. Obviously, you're a fan of political-themed movies. What did this movie allow you to do, taking it to Latin America?
I think it was, we could sort of comment about how we elect our officials without having to sort of hit it over the head and do it here. You know, it's based on a true story, though we've taken a lot of license.
Loosely based.
We've taken a lot of license. So it was set in, I mean, it was, the documentary is set in Bolivia. But, you know, we also just love the It was very funny, the documentary. It's just very, it was absurd and ironic, and that was attractive.
Grant and I did a TV series that we produced with Steven Soderbergh called K Street, where we basically, for 14 weeks, shared an office with Mary Matlin and James Carville and Michael Deaver and Ken Adelman was there and Stu Stevens. So literally, like, the, you know, Mary at the time was chief of staff for Dick Cheney. We were in the office when they came in and they taped up our computers in the Justice Department because of the Scooter Libby thing. So we were around watching really interesting things happen on the ground as they're happening. And it's really funny to watch political operatives. It's really interesting to watch that process and the behind the scenes conversations and how it, you know, how people are actually just, you know, we take things much more personally than they do. You know, these guys could work for other sides. It's sort of, and they do often. And you'll see, I'll get really angry at something that somebody says, and you know, the politician won't be angry at all. It's just part of the game that they play. They'll go out later and have a drink and laugh about it. So it's so much more fun to watch how it works as an industry and see that it actually is an industry and it isn't all just this passionate belief system. And I always thought that was fun. Not that Mary and James aren't passionate about what they believe in, but that there were a lot of people there that really just did things because they liked the idea of winning.
Did you ever drop anything that you saw from the political world into one of your political projects? Anything crazy or insane?
Yeah. Well, like Ides of March is full of it, but you know, we can't tell you which ones.
Okay, he's got the mic.
Sandra, this part was originally written for Amal. What point in your career, what was the tipping point that made you start looking at roles that were written for men and start saying, I want to approach these?
I want to be a man? Yeah.
And what did you learn looking at those roles? And then for David and Grant and George, what was it like for Sandra to step up and say she wanted to take the part? And has it changed your perception of how roles for men and women are written?
My quest, what'd you say?
I said full body shape.
My quest started before this film when I was looking at comedies. I was like, why is the only comedy that's available for women romantic comedies? I was so done. But I yearned for comedy. So I started, I was like, can I look at every script that Jim Carrey didn't want to do just see if that can be switched? It started a while ago, just looking, and nothing really popped up that I felt was extraordinary, and then The Heat showed up, which was sort of, I felt, out of the need for women to have a comedy that wasn't centered around getting a man. And nothing wrong with that, Anthony. Getting men is great. I saw the face. See, I don't even have to look at him. He's like, what's wrong with men? I love men. Don't need to always be talking about you. And then what was the other part? Oh, Was that, it? Was that my, am I done?
What have you learned looking up these words?
I've learned absolutely nothing. No, I've learned that you can't worry about getting a no. I mean, I'm just used to, I think we're pretty, as actors, used to getting no's in this business, but you have to keep going forward or you'd never work again. So I've learned that, you know, sometimes just asking, you know, can't hurt to ask, and I'm glad I asked, and they could have said no, but they didn't, you know.
You really couldn't say no, really.
I wanted to.
Try.
No, but, I mean, he jokes, but this was something they developed for a long time, and it had, you know, they don't haphazardly develop anything. So it could have been very precious. It you know, I could have changed the tone that you guys were looking for. Could have.
Yeah, but, you know, there's another part of this, which is that we wanted to work with you, and when the minute that you suggested the idea and we looked at it, we thought, well, this is silly that we would even think it wouldn't work. You know, it made total sense. So I think that it's just a natural progression. You know, we talked about it. It gets talked about a lot lately about how, why don't, you know, more roles get switched. There are a lot of roles that could be. There are a lot of reasons why it was mostly women who were starring in movies in the 30s, you know, and leading the film. There's been a great change in the mentality. I don't know, maybe because most of the studios are run by men, I have no idea, but I do believe that somewhere in here, everybody can look at their development a little bit and say, well, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, all the guys, you know. We develop things because, you know, I might want to work on it as an actor, but it doesn't mean that it has to be me that does it. It makes more sense with her in it, and she's so wonderful in the part that, you know, there wasn't a moment's doubt, I don't think.
David, oh, sorry.
I had a few moments doubt.
How'd you get over it?
Now that I saw the film, I feel better.
David, anything to add since the question was directed at you as well?
Well, I mean, I just think, I remember the first film I made, George Washington, was in 2000. It dealt with mostly young people, various races, actually various ages. And I made a point not to ever refer to age or race. So it's, you know, a 30-year-old white guy is having a conversation with an 11-year-old African-American kid, but there was no, even the dialogue wasn't mannered. Like, it was just two people having a conversation. And I've really taken that philosophy because I had that as a kid. It's something that, you know, was a very naive part of my upbringing in a very diverse economic and cultural part of Dallas, Texas, where I grew up. And I think it's nice just to look at story, you look at character, and not have to necessarily fall into the cliches, but just look to people as people in a, you know, and you know, there's so many lovely, amazing, you know, varieties of people within our, and strange and off-putting as well, types of people. Like, I just like looking at, you know, at people and not necessarily tending to address the stereotypes and cliches as they can often be and be portrayed in movies.
Steve? Oh, okay. George, the New York Times yesterday ran a piece about movies with impact for maybe Hillary Clinton for the coming election, with the Benghazi movie that Michael Bay's got coming out in January.
Michael Bay is a Benghazi.
Nice.
Yeah, Michael Bay's
coming out in January.
You can't wait. Anyway.
that's my friend, John Krasinski's in it, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Good. Well, I hope it does very well then.
Name dropper.
But it's said about this movie.
David Letterman told me not to.
Name dropper again.
It said about this movie that you changed all the names and airbrushed all the Clinton associations out.
Well, that's not true. We changed the names because, you know, we weren't doing the exact same story, and, you know, that'll get you in trouble anytime you keep the real names and change the story.
Okay.
So it wasn't, we didn't change it to disassociate from anybody.
I don't think we ever mentioned the Clintons once.
Not once.
In 8 years that we worked on this film.
Okay. No,
I mean, the reality was it was a documentary that we knew if we were going to fictionalize some pieces of it, we were going to have to change the names, like we did on Michael Clayton, where it was clearly about you know, a much different industry than what we were doing, and so because of it, we had to change the names. You know, you do that so you don't get sued a lot.
They asked us, we would have told them that.
Yeah.
Question here?
Mike,
I have a question for Sandra. You know, since this movie is about the interaction with Latin America, I wonder what is your personal opinion with the Hispanic community in the United States, and what would your character say to Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton during this campaign?
Depends on who my character was working for and who was paying her. Depends on where the money's flowing from. My character only goes where the money goes, at the beginning of the film. So whoever was paying her, she'd have whatever advice. I think they're actually doing really well on their own. I think they've got pretty good people working behind them, so she doesn't need to step in. But what would I say to... What was the question?
Your personal opinion about the Hispanic community in America.
Well, I never separate the Hispanic community from America. You know, it's like I don't... I mean, my friends, my family, like, are from the Hispanic community. So I've never looked at that like as a separate thing to address and what I would say to them. Like, if it's a good person, come into my fold. If you're not a good person, stay out of my house.
So what do you think then about Donald Trump and what he's saying?
I don't agree with that at all. Thought that was not a statement that I can get behind. I don't agree with that statement.
First, I want to tell you guys, brilliant, brilliant film.
You are our favorite interviewer today. Keep going.
Thank you.
See, this is how you suck up. I don't care if she's lying, just say it. And then to review your opinions honestly when we're gone, but just lay it on.
After all these years, I don't blow smoke up any of you. It's brilliant.
Okay.
Brilliant job. But what stands out for me with this film is the satire and the emotion. You could have gone so far left, so far right. You really could have gone off the rails. You don't. And I'd like to hear from Grant and George and David about how you found that sweet spot in the emotional tonal bandwidth of the film and what your considerations were in executing that on screen.
Well, you know, Peter Strong, who wrote the script, he deserves a lot of the credit for that, because he captured the tone that we had hoped for and that we talked about. And then, you know, then the rest goes to David and the actors, because those are the guys who really, you know, executed it. It is a really tricky tone.
It's interesting. If you look at every cast member in the movie, they're incredibly dramatically and comedically capable. And the environment of making the movie was very playful. I mean, it was long hours, and you know, you're making a movie, and there's certain frustration and obstacles, but it was a great vibe, a great energy. And so when there's that kind of positivity, you're inclined to have as much fun as possible and push some comedic buttons and play with the wit and exaggerate that to some degree. And with that script, we had a great foundation for all that. And then it's a matter of trying to find the restraint and heart. And we did takes that were outrageous and ridiculous, and others that were poignant and tender. And to me, that's just the playful part of the process. And then you get in the editing room and you really start to sculpt and try to find how far you can go without losing the foundation of emotion that I felt was very, very important. And so it just becomes the collaboration of sitting in there in the room and trying things out and putting in front of audiences and see how people respond. And can you get away with a llama getting hit by a car? We filmed it and didn't know, but you know.
Did you film a llama being hit by a car? No
llamas were hurt. Just
wanted to make sure. I wanted to clarify.
But it is that kind of thing where we film a lot. We roll and we try it, and it's a very bold cast that are fearless. And so you know they're we trust each other and we challenge each other and then we figure it out later.
Where's the mic?
Question. George,
use the mic.
George, after so many years filming about politics and sure. movies related to politics, do you still believe in the power of politics, or are you disillusioned? And the second question for Sandra and Billy, who seriously needs a Pat and Candy in this year's election?
Who is this year's Pat?
Oh, who needs a Jane and a Pat in this year's election?
Oh, good God. George, talk while I try and think of it.
Maybe I'll tap dance while you think of an answer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, of course I still believe in the political process. I believe that government can, you know, at its best is designed to look after the people who can't look after themselves. And I think that that's our responsibility, to hold our government to task for that. And I consider that part of each of our responsibilities as citizens. And so, yeah, I always am frustrated by it, but it's, you know, it moves incrementally forward, and sometimes it's three steps backwards. But I still very much believe in the process, and I will continue to be as much a part of it as I can be, you know, because I'm, because I'm a citizen of the country.
Would you run for office?
No. He's running right now.
I just ran. No, I've been asked that for almost 20 years now, you know, and the answer is just no. I mean, who would ever want to live like that? I mean, I'm friends with a lot of those guys, and I just think it's hell. I just think it's, you know, I commend people who go into public service, because it's just such a horrible way to get elected. It's such a horrible time while you're in office. It's more polarized now than probably, you know, arguably since the Civil War in many ways. And I think, you know, same people will argue over things that they believed in 6 years ago or 8 years ago, because it's not their guy saying it. So, no, I wouldn't want to be in politics. I have no interest in it. I have every interest in being involved from the outside and trying to get things done that are important to me, important to the things that I care about.
What is your coping mechanism for disillusionment?
What do you mean, coping mechanism? Yeah, drinking. Thank you, Grant.
So, Sandra and Billy Bob, who needs a Pat Candy? Who needs a Jane?
Come on, I've talked forever.
I mean, I think the beauty about this day and age is that, you know, I'd rather no one have a Pat and Jane, because you can't, because of the way that the world is today, you can't live a hidden life. Is someone running for office, everything is going to be found out. I'd rather everyone mess up and present exactly who they are, and it not be so well-oiled and run and manipulated, so we can make a decision about who we really want based on who the people truly are. I mean, it's gotten really difficult to hide, and even the masterminds and the puppeteers now can't hide this stuff anymore. Do you know what I mean? They can't control, as we've seen, you know, either side. It's all going to come out. The dirt just keeps resurfacing, and mud keeps getting flung. I want to see the people be as genuine and authentic as possible, no matter how unraveled that might be, no matter how together that might be. You know, I don't want them to have a Jane and Pat. I want to see the mess unfold so I can make at least some kind of honest decision on who's going to be in charge of everything.
Okay, we have time for a couple more questions.
Juan Carlos García from Mexico, David and Sandra. Can you talk about the process of choosing Reynaldo Pacheco for the character in Sandra? Do you have any experience?
One more time with the question.
Can you talk about, share some experience working with Reynaldo?
Oh, Reynaldo, okay, yeah.
Reynaldo, I don't know, how was working with him, and what do you think about him? And how did you choose him for the role?
He's the young boy. Really
Eddie
famous.
Plays Eddie in the film that Reynaldo Pacheco. We did substantial outreach trying to find the perfect Eddie. You know, and in a lot of ways, it's the heart and soul of the movie, and a pivot point for Jane Bodine's character. And so he represented a lot, and it was the one substantial role that I felt needed to be Bolivian, and when I met Reynaldo, he had that energy and that innocence. There's something about Eddie that's very optimistic, to the point of being naive, to the point of being frustrating sometimes. But I think Reynaldo is very savvy and educated and knew how to kind of navigate some of those difficult detours, and to be able to use those looks in the eye and those little moments, the slivers of smile that can transform someone that is in that difficult position that Jane is in. So it was great working with him and being able to spend time in Bolivia with Reynaldo and his family, and it's great to have any sort of. I went to this weird rock doctor with him down there, which he could put all these stones on you and take you to strange journeys. And so Ronaldo's a guy that, you know, you just want to, you know, live the adventure a little bit with.
Sandra, did he seem intimidated at all?
Not at all. I mean, he is smart and sharp and savvy as he might be. He did possess still the remnants of innocence. I mean, I don't think I can look in anyone's eyes here and say there are remnants of innocence in any of our eyes. But he had that thing that you look at him and you go, oh my God, he doesn't know, or oh my God, he doesn't think that or feel that. He still comes at you with a, what if this is possible? And you're like, oh honey, it's not. But I love that he hasn't gotten there yet. He hasn't allowed life to chip away at that beautiful hopefulness. And that was needed, and you don't get that in a lot of actors because we all come in and it's a game and that gets lost very quickly. But he had that, and that's what you see. That's why you could hang so much of the movie on his moments of loss and grief, and you feel it because he is, to a certain degree, a lot of the character.
Mike?
For George and Grant, even with your track record doing social and political movies, is it difficult still to get these kind of projects off the ground? Is there a resistance to movies that might have some kind of consequential message?
Yeah, it's never been easy.
How do you guys fight that?
Get Sandy to do the movie.
Yeah.
And I'm a woman. I'm a woman.
Yeah. It gets a lot easier when you get Sandy in there. Yeah. That's the truth. Look, it's very hard. You got to keep the budgets down on these things, and you have to work really, you know, quickly, and you have to sort of try and get it finished before everybody figures out what you're doing. You know. So that's the truth.
And so, what effect do they have?
I don't care. You know. We're not. Remember that films aren't designed to lead, right? Films reflect on things. It takes you 2 years to make a film, so we're reacting to things that have happened before and holding a mirror up to society and saying this is what happened. It's a record of what we've been doing. So our job isn't to tell people what to do. It's to have them reflect and say, this is what you did. Isn't that interesting? And you know, and so it's social at times. It's political at times. Although that's not necessarily our whole MO.
We do want to entertain.
Yeah, we try to, you know, I mean, we've done a few, you know, Good Night, Good Luck was pretty overtly political, but, you know, we've done quite a few that were, you know, that were focused on entertaining. So.
And then to end up with, and this will double as our all-important voice print, go down the line and tell me, each of you, who of the eight people at this table, knowing you all know each other as well as you do, who would make the best political consultant of the eight people at this table? So Grant, we'll start with you, and that'll be your voice print. Just the name.
Grant Heslov.
You would make the best.
Oh, you want me to
make the best. That's the brightest.
Grant Heslov.
Okay.
Grant Heslov.
Grant Heslov.
Okay. Zoe?
Grant Heslov.
Wow. Anthony?
I would say Zoe.
Mm.
Sandra
Bullock. I would say Zoe as well.
Grant Heslov.
I'd say Grant.
I'll go Zoe.
Tribe has spoken. 5 votes, Grant. 3 votes, Zoe.
Which means the other 8 of us are shit.
Right. If you want to lose, hire me.
Thank you guys. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
How fun was it being back on the bus?
No,
I gotta ask you.
Oh,
God, not at all. Not at all. It was a fun scene, though. It was really good. Thank you.
You got